Good morning, everyone. We're going to call a joint committee of the Government Operations Policy Committee and the Civil Law Committee to order. I want to welcome everyone here today for this important discussion. Today we have the Office of the Legislative Auditor here today to give us an overview of the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange, or MinSure. And so we're going to turn it over to both of you, just to have you introduce yourselves for the record, and we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor, and with me is Joel Alter, the manager of our evaluation of MinSure. Mr. Chairman and members of the Joint Committee, I really want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you this morning and for your willingness to come back to this report, which has been heard by a number of committees. But I think the focus that these two committees can give some issues that we raised is really important on governance and some issues about data security as well. So we really appreciate that. You know, our report was, and we acknowledge this, about the past. We looked at the first year of operation of MinSure, and we had a lot of concerns and a lot of criticism. But we also need to think about the future. How do we go forward? And I think the issues that we raised, particularly about governance, are where to really focus, because that's, we think, what the legislature can do to make MinSure more accountable and more transparent. There are always a lot of strengths and weaknesses to various kinds of organizational arrangements. And some will argue that there are certainly benefits to having a board in charge of MinSure. But we think that that has obscured some of the accountability. And so we have suggested that the governor ought to make the appointment of the executive director. We did not address whether or not you should keep the board or not. I know that there are members who favor keeping a board, and I know there are members of the legislature in favor of abolishing the board. That is a decision that, again, will have both pros and cons either way. So again, Mr. Chairman and members, we really appreciate you taking up these issues, because we really do think there is work to be done this legislative session to ensure that MinSure has the kind of governance structure and accountability and transparency that will help it function better in the future. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Alter to make a brief presentation.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Joel Alter with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I also want to acknowledge the other two staff who worked on our MinSure report, Ryan Moulds and Laura Schwartz, who are in the audience. Mr. Chairman, as Mr. Noble said, I'm going to give an abbreviated presentation of our MinSure report today. And for those of you who have heard us talk about this before, I'm not going to go through what a health insurance exchange is, how much money was spent, what the consumer experience is, although we're certainly willing to take questions if you have them. As Mr. Noble said, we're going to focus today on primarily three things: the exemptions in state law that were given to MinSure and how it's different from other agencies, governance, and some data issues, and be happy to take questions about any other issues later. But let me begin with the overall conclusions for this report. Essentially, we concluded that MinSure overpromised and underperformed, at least through its first year of operations. Exchange officials set very high expectations for establishing this health insurance exchange, one that would be easy for consumers and others to use. And in fact, at least through that first year, it was very difficult to use. A lot of people, consumers, insurers, counties, and others, have put up with a system that did not work as well as intended. And that sometimes meant that there were people who wanted to get insurance and who couldn't get it, or they had to wait for longer than they expected. It also meant a lot of extra work for some of the organizations that were charged with managing cases of these individuals. Going forward, MinSure faces some important challenges. It's got to be financially viable. The system has got to provide a better user experience. This system has got to make eligibility determinations, both for people who are qualifying for tax credits as well as people who are qualifying for public programs. And those eligibility determinations have to be accurate. And it isn't the focus of our discussion today, but that has been an issue in the early months of MinSure. So in general, MinSure must execute better, and it's got to be held accountable for its performance. One thing that I want to emphasize today, and I think that sometimes we get into talking about MinSure as being a quasi-state agency or focusing on some of its differences, and I want to say kind of what the Legislative Auditor's Office perspective on MinSure is. MNCHR is a state agency. It does have differences from some of the state agencies that you may be used to looking at, but MNCHR is a state agency. It certainly is different from some of the major state departments, and as Mr. Noble said, one of those key differences is that MNCHR is governed by a board as opposed to having a governor-appointed commissioner. MNCHR has a 7-member board. 6 of those members are appointed by the governor to serve on the board, and then the 7th member is the Commissioner of Human Services. You will find some other state agencies that have boards or commissions. Certainly agencies like the Pollution Control Agency or the Public Utilities Commission come to mind, but I think it's important to point out that governance by a board is the exception and not the rule. Another difference, MNCHR is authorized for any rulemaking it does to use an expedited process to develop those rules. Usually with other agencies, and there certainly are other occasions when agencies are granted authority to use an expedited process, but generally the legislature has done that on a case-by-case basis. MNCHR has general authority to develop any rules through an expedited process, and it has used that process a couple of times in its history. A third difference, MNCHR is exempt from some state laws. In our view, the most consequential exemption in state law is the exemption that the legislature gave to MNCHR from oversight by the Office of Minute Services as it develops IT projects. And certainly keep in mind that a lot of what MNCHR does is all about IT and trying to make sure that it has a website that on the front end works well for consumers and on the back end works well for the insurers and the counties and the others that have to make use of that information. As we talk about at length in the report, when MNCHR built the exchange, when it built this IT infrastructure, MNCHR and the exchange officials did not seek the help from the state's IT experts, specifically the Office of Minute Services, that it really should have. They were a partner. They did play a role in this development, but they were not really invited guests at the beginning. And later on, the legislature statutorily exempted MNCHR from Minute oversight. So we think that's an important exemption, and I know you're going to be there's going to be discussion of a bill a little bit later. There are other exemptions in law that I won't say as much about, but MNCHR is exempted from many of the procurement provisions of state law that apply to other agencies. There are also some Department of Administration requirements that MNCHR is exempted from. Fourth, there are some differences in MNCHR's conflict of interest provisions than what you'll find from many other agencies. With MNCHR, state law prohibits certain categories of people from serving on the MNCHR board. With most state boards, what you'll find is that those boards come under general conflict of interest laws that pertain generally and not to specific agencies. And so if there are members of those boards that have a conflict, they would, in those circumstances, recuse themselves from participating in a decision. MNCHR has some more specific, more detailed conflict of interest provisions, and I think for some people, that is a good thing. For other people, they may question why MNCHR needs to be different from other state agencies. There is some specific language, for example, in the MNCHR law. For example, a MNCHR board member cannot have a spouse who is a health insurer executive. So not only are the restrictions on the individuals who serve on the board, but in that case also on the spouses of board members. So some fairly specific language in MNCHR law regarding conflict of interest. And finally, state law specifies that all of MNCHR's managerial staff are in the unclassified service, and that is unusual among state agencies to have all of the managerial staff covered in that way. I want to shift to talking about governance and leading up to what our recommendations were in that area. And we've mentioned already that MNCHR is governed by a 7-member board, that that's unusual among agencies. We're not going to go through the history of MNCHR today, but I think it's important to say that the MNCHR board, again, it is the governing body, but that board did not have full authority over this agency until just shortly before the enrollment system went live in October of 2013. By statute, the MNsure board was required to develop bylaws and policies, and then once it had done that, then it could assume its full authority. And so the MNsure board completed that process of developing bylaws in August of 2013, just a few weeks before enrollment started. So, you know, I think there are certainly those who would point fingers in a lot of places with the shortcomings of MNsure, and the board certainly deserves some blame for some things that have happened. But I think it's also important to point out that this board did not have its authority for most of the period where there was planning and actual implementation of some key parts of the system. Regarding that period when the board developed policies, and again, that's what the board was doing in its early months, we looked at those policies and found that for some of the key policies, there had been limited follow-through. For example, the policies required, from the beginning, monthly and quarterly financial reporting to the board. That generally has not occurred. There was a policy that required development of MNsure goals in key areas, for example, goals regarding the affordability and accessibility of health insurance. Those haven't been developed. So even in those cases where the board devoted its attention in the early months, there has not been the follow-through that I think would be reasonable to expect. Some comments about MNsure administration and the role that they play. Again, state law says that the governing board may hire staff as needed, and the governing board appoints the MNsure CEO. Again, that person is not a governor's appointee, and so there is very little direct accountability to elected officials. There is instead this kind of indirect accountability. During 2013, when MNsure was trying to get the exchange up and running for October 2013, administrative leadership in MNsure were not very forthcoming about the status of the project. They were not forthcoming, in some cases, with their own board members. Board members sometimes asked fairly detailed questions about the status of things, where things were at, and they got fairly short and incomplete answers to those questions. Meanwhile, others in the administration, including the governor, were not told until late in the process what the significant challenges really were that the system was facing until it was really quite close to the go-live date. There was a lot of hard work by MNsure administrators and staff, as well as other agencies and the vendors who were helping to build this system. But I think there was also significant miscalculation on the part of MNsure staff, leaders, about their ability to deliver a well-functioning exchange in the amount of time that they had. Administrative officials within MNsure set high expectations, and they certainly deserve some of the blame for not being able to deliver. Well, we've talked a bit about MNsure, the agency, but we also talk in our report about MNsure, the enrollment system. MNsure has built this IT system that is ongoing and that is, in many ways, apart from the agency. And the question is this MNsure system, and who makes decisions about what changes will be made to the system? Well, MNsure and DHS certainly rely very directly on the system to enroll individuals in commercial insurance as well as in public programs like medical assistance and Minnesota Care. And meanwhile, you've got the Office of Minute Services, which built the security parts of the system. And even though you've got the guts of the system that were built by vendors, the operating parts of the system were largely vendor-developed, ultimately, those become the Office of Minute Services' responsibility to maintain and continue. There was, for a time when the system was being developed, a governance structure for this IT system. As the technical problems became more apparent and escalated during 2013, that governance structure largely dissolved. And so as the system moved forward and through 2014, there was a bit of a void, and finally MNsure and DHS and Minute got together and in late 2014 put in place a new governance structure for the IT system. So you may hear references to an executive steering committee or a change control board or other parts of that structure. But these, as we point out in our report, have been assembled in a very informal way. You won't find an interagency agreement or bylaws or agency policies, much less state laws that articulate what this IT governance structure looks like or who serves on these entities. And the Department of Human Services in particular has expressed concern to us about the informality of this process. They'd like to see greater clarity in the composition of that governance structure, as well as clarity about exactly how the priorities are going to be set, because DHS relies a lot on that IT system. Our recommendations to the legislature, as Mr. Nobles mentioned, first of all, we recommended amending the law so that the governor, rather than the MNCHR board, would appoint the MNCHR CEO. And that would provide MNCHR administrative leadership with a more direct line of accountability to an elected official. Our rationale is that, and it certainly has become apparent, that this agency, MNCHR, is highly visible and highly important, has impacts on many Minnesotans, and we just like want to see a more direct form of accountability. So if the MNCHR CEO is a governor appointee, then the natural question to ask is, what about the board? Should the board continue to exist? And if it does exist, what role should it play? And I should mention, there are instances in state government, a good example would be the Pollution Control Agency, where we do have an organization that has both a commissioner appointed by the governor and a board. So that's not outside the realm of possibility. But I think, again, it's important for the legislature to think through, what does it want this board to do? Is there a unique function that this board could play? And if so, perhaps it could continue to perform a governing function, or it could certainly continue in some sort of advisory role to the administrative director of MNCHR. It became clear to us as we did the study that there also needed to be some arrangement for the governance of this IT system that has been created. At a minimum, having something in law that outlines exactly what this structure is. But in doing that, we think the legislature should give careful consideration to the composition of this governance structure. And finally, we think that MNCHR should be subject to the ongoing oversight by MNIT, the same oversight that other agencies receive. We understand that there was a really ambitious timeline that led to the development of MNCHR, and a lot of things had to happen in those early months in a very short period of time. There are still a lot of things to be done to get MNCHR's IT system in the shape that it needs to be in. But we do think that going forward, it makes sense to have MNIT be statutorily a partner in that process. MNIT is certainly working much more closely with MNCHR today than it was, let's say, 18 months ago. But there really is no reason that we can come up with for continuing to have MNIT be exempted in statute. The last issue that I want to talk about before opening things up for questions are some issues related to data. And certainly as we began our evaluation and during it and in the aftermath, there have been questions that legislators have raised about data collected by MNCHR. There's a lot of private data collected by MNCHR, and people have said, is it secure? Is it usable? And what I can tell you is this, and our office, we're not the IT experts, particularly related to data security. We have some staff who do audits of that, but we talked with the Office of MNIT Services about the system that has been developed at MNCHR. What I can tell you is that they are convinced that that is a state-of-the-art system for data security. They told us it is the best data security system that has been built in state government. Having said that, can also say that that system does not yet meet all of the requirements that have been set forth by the federal government for data security in health insurance exchanges. How do we know that? Well, there have been two independent audits of MNCHR's data security. One was done in the months right before the system went live, October 2013. And the second data security audit was done in the middle of 2014. In neither case did those audits find that all of the pieces were in place to ensure the security standards that the federal government had set forth. Many of them were in place, but even as we checked with the Office of Minute Services last fall, there were still pieces that were not yet compliant with the federal standards. Another issue that we talk about, because it is specifically mentioned in state law, is something that is called the Minsure Audit Trail. There is a requirement in law that Minsure have an audit trail for individuals' information within the system. What does this mean? Well, let's say you are an enrollee in Minsure, and you have some question about who's looked at my data. Is it somebody within Minsure that has authority to access that data? Or is there any evidence that somebody has come into the system and taken a look at the data that shouldn't have access to that data? Well, the legislature required creation of an audit trail so that there would be clear information on who has accessed data. What I can tell you is that Minsure does have an audit trail of sorts, but not exactly what it had intended to and hoped to implement initially. Minsure can go into, again, let's say you're an enrollee, Minsure can access your records and look up who has accessed your individual records, and they can do those kinds of individual lookups. What Minsure cannot do is it cannot look over the whole range of individuals who are enrolled in Minsure and do what some might call data mining to look for any indications that somebody has gone in inappropriately and accessed records and then do follow-ups. That was what Minsure hoped to have, that broader ability, but instead they can do the individual lookups today. So there is a functionality that has not yet been developed. We sensed that there was some confusion both in information that had been presented to the legislature about those capabilities and in legislators' understanding of what those capabilities were, so we felt that was important to sort out. The last thing I'll mention regarding data, we observed that Minsure, which has collected, again, a wealth of information on enrollees, but it is extremely difficult to extract that information from Minsure's system just for purposes of management analysis. So Minsure has struggled at times even to provide information to its own board or to respond to questions from legislators or the media or the public, because some of that information is very difficult to extract. And I will say we encountered this firsthand. We had to get an extract of information to do a lot of the analysis that went into our report. And it was not easy. We worked very closely with the Office of Minute Services to get the information we needed. This has to be among Minsure's future tasks, to find a way to improve its own ability to access information so that when questions arise, they can answer them more readily. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to stop there. Again, we focused on these limited issues today. We're open to questions on anything else related to our report, but we'll stop there and pause.
Thank you, Mr. Alter, and thank you, Mr. Nobles, very much for the presentation. We really appreciate it. Just so everyone has a bit of a roadmap here, we'll have an open discussion until about 11:20 p.m., and then we'll adjourn this. We'll take about a five-minute break and then restart the Government Operations Committee to take up House File 18 at that point. So we'll go with questions and answers until about 11:20, unless members finish up earlier than that. First on the list, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for the testimony. I did hear it at a joint meeting of HHS and Finance and Reform, so I won't go over my same concerns I mentioned there already. But I do have two questions and just a quick follow-up question or comment. The you know, since I heard your report at the HHS joint meetings, Tom Forsythe has come out in the Star Tribune and actually was a little bit honest. I appreciate that. But one of the things he said in his article is DHS should operate the public programs. Minsure should help Minnesotans compare and buy insurance. So basically he's saying that Minsure should be divided between public programs, which we know is about over 90% of the enrollee, versus
private insurance. In your audit, did you look at that aspect in any way? Do you have any opinion about that suggestion?
Mr. Chairman, Nobles. Representative Grunhagen and members, it is an issue that is being discussed, frankly, even beyond Mr. Forsyth's commentary. And I know there are people who believe that that would have a good result to separate the commercial selling of insurance and have that be the responsibility of Minsure and then take the other part of the system and put it under the jurisdiction of DHS for the public programs. It may make some sense, but I think technologically it would be extremely difficult to do. This system was designed and built to be integrated. And so just at a technological level, it would take effort, it would take time, and it would undoubtedly take more money. There may be other ways to simply keep the system integrated together and have different governance structures over different parts. You know, I understand that there is some tension, frankly, between some board members having responsibility for the public programs. I think their desire would be more to simply serve the commercial market. But again, 90% now, between 85 and 90% of the people that use Minsure are signing up for the public programs. So there are a lot of issues, both technical, governance, and even financial, into whether or not separating the two parts would be viable.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Next question is, you know, we talked about spending $140 million in this article with another proposed $89 million. To me, it's good money after bad, but that's my opinion. But do you believe the next $89 million worth of spending will actually solve the technological problems and the problems Minsure is having?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunhagen, we don't have, I guess, an opinion on the plan, which the last we knew was still being developed by Minsure as to exactly how they would invest that additional 80-some million dollars. And so Minsure would certainly be better able to speak to kind of going forward. But I guess what I would say is this. We have spent we have received from the federal government at this point about $190 million in grants to develop this exchange. And we have an exchange that has been up and working now for two enrollment cycles, and many people have been enrolled through that. It has not been a good consumer experience for many people. But beyond that, and I think we've certainly heard this in the hearings that we've attended and where Minsure leaders have testified, there is an enormous amount of work to be done yet, both on the front end to make this a better system for consumers and allow better comparisons of insurance products, but also serious problems on the back end that continue to exist. Insurance companies that still cannot get electronically transferred information on people that have enrolled. Counties who are still trying to manage their public program caseloads and can't today figure out how many people they have on those caseloads or get in and look at all of the information that they should be able to look at. There is a lot of work to be done. Can Minsure do it with the money that they've set aside this year? What I can tell you is the federal money runs out this year. They have to spend it this year. So they have a lot of work to do this year, and next enrollment period is going to be very telling. But as far as whether that's a realistic agenda, I think Minsure could speak to that better.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add one quick point. Because in all of these discussions, I have not heard mention of Deloitte, which Minsure brought in and paid $4 million to give an analysis and develop a plan for going forward. And I think at some point, some legislative committee or maybe the Joint Oversight Committee for Minsure might want to hear from Deloitte and their assessment of where things stand. And I would certainly hope and encourage Deloitte to give you a very frank and candid assessment. I think the public, the legislature, deserves that from the money they paid to Deloitte to come up with that plan.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Representative Grunhagen.
You know, maybe Mr. Leitz could speak to that question better than the auditors, if he'd want to come forward.
Mr. Leitz, if you're prepared, you can step down and Welcome to the committee. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record. And then we'll have Representative Grunhagen, if you want to restate your question.
Yeah, the question was, we've spent about $140 million. Now we're proposing to spend another $89 million. Will the $89 million cure the goose or kill the goose? Okay. I hate to spend hard-earned tax dollars. People are trying to pay their electric bills, buy clothes for their children, grandchildren, and et cetera, on needs while we just flush money, you know, good money after bad here on this disaster, according to Tom Forsythe, which I completely agree with that comment. So do you think the $89 billion will cure the problem?
Mr. Lights, welcome again to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Scott Lights. I'm with MNsure as the CEO. Representative Grunhagen, to your question, the additional federal funding that we applied for and received was really focused on two things. One was to improve the consumer experience and continue to improve that. I think what we saw this year, where we focused for open enrollment that just ended on February 15th, was really on improving the consumer side of this, that as people came through, they had a much better experience. And we did find that to be the case this year. So I think the focus was appropriate and right in doing so. Where we need to, though, to focus, and Auditor Nobles and Mr. Alter have pointed this out, and I think very accurately and correctly, there's a lot of work to be done on the back side of the system. This is this part of the system that transfers information to the health plans, that allows county workers to make changes to cases as they need to, that allows our other partners, brokers and agents, who are very important, navigators and others, to really work directly in the system. They're not able to do that today, and they need to be able to do that. So the focus of the next round of work is really going to be on those areas. We do believe that we can make substantial progress. Will it solve every single problem? I can't pledge that, and I wouldn't pledge that. I think there will still, this is an ongoing IT build, and like any other ongoing IT build, there are issues that incrementally need to be worked on over time. However, we do believe that the work that will be done over the course of the next year leading up to the next open enrollment period, which starts in November of this coming year, of 2015, will be substantially important in improving that system.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll leave other reps have an opportunity to ask questions, too, but thank you for that response, Mr. Lights. I thought it could be answered with a yes or no, but evidently there's a longer explanation. But anyway, with some caveats. You know, I tend to agree with Mr. Forsythe when he says in the article, he says, let's be honest, this isn't working, the vision was flawed, the strategy was terrible, it's time for change. And I guess, members, this strategy of Obamacare MNsure has failed on almost every level to meet its expectations. It's driven up premiums. The only way premiums come down is with tax credits. Even Gruber, I always forget the R in that name, said it was stupid to vote for it, okay? And I tend to agree with him. You know, this is what's so disconcerting about all this is this is the wrong solution at the wrong time in Minnesota and U.S. history. And what I mean by that is the baby boomers are retiring. We don't have them, we're not going to have them as productive citizens going forward. So our costs are going to skyrocket. This plan, MNsure and Obamacare, is based on centralized government planning, which is going to increase cost and be inefficient and ultimately lead to rationed health care. When we look at the price of gas, did gas come down due to government centralized planning? No, it came down due to private sector competition and American ingenuity. That's what brought our gas price down. In fact, you could argue government was an impediment to bringing the gas price down. It's true in healthcare. We can have lower costs, better access for all Minnesotans, but not with more government. This is fatally flawed. The only thing that's going to happen out of this going forward is it's going to get worse in terms of higher premiums, less access, and more inefficiencies. So I urge us, and this is a bipartisan comment, okay? It was Mitt Romney in Massachusetts that gave this to us, all right? And Obamacare is simply a duplicate of that. So let's initiate private sector reforms that actually reduce cost and increase access and stop this socialistic centralized government planning experiment that is simply wasting our hard-earned tax dollars in this state and nation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Scott.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Nobles and Mr. Lights, so Mr. Lights, don't get up yet. maybe this is for Mr. Alter. On page 4, the second slide, the third bullet point down, Venture can track who has access to person's data but can't search broadly for indications of inappropriate access. Does that include hackers? Do they have something set up so that the lights will flash and bells will ring if there's been a hacker into the system?
Madam Chair, I believe we are going to call on Mr. Chris Boozy from Minute to answer that question, the state's security officer and former employee of the Office of the Legislative Audit.
Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would, introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Christopher Boozy. I'm an assistant commissioner and chief security officer for Minute Service in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Boozy, did you hear my question, or do you want me to repeat it?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I did hear the question, and the Minsure system has multiple technologies that are involved in order to alert us to hacker activities. So there's several different active monitoring solutions that are in place to basically gather events that happen on a day-to-day basis. The technologies are commonly referred to as intrusion detection and prevention systems. There also are some very sophisticated systems that are called security information and event management systems, and the purpose of those systems is to take alert type data that is passed on by all the different pieces of equipment that are part of the system in order for us to find anomalies and try and stop them as they occur. So there are preventive controls in place, as you're referring to. There are also a series of detective controls that are in place as well.
Thank
Chair
you.
Chair Scott.
Thank you. And then to Mr. Lights, I had a question. Mr. Lights, I seem to remember in the past, it seems like there was either whisperings of this or actually it was already in place to ask for some of our money back from the contractor, whoever that was, that set up this system, the software system. And I just wondered if that's still in the works, if that was, you know, help me with my memory here and my recollection. Was something like that talked about?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I think what you're referring to is with some of the vendors who set up the system, were we in a place of either asking for a refund or asking for some money back? Is that sort of phrasing your question, essentially?
Chair Scott.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, what we really focused on was improving that contracting process. General Counsel Mike Turpin is here if we want to go into detail on how we've done that, but really our focus wasn't necessarily around getting money back for what was done, but rather actually getting the deliverables that were in the contract originally. Those, quite honestly, to date have not been delivered, and so we are continuing to revise the contracts, work with the vendors to ensure that we're actually getting the deliverables that were originally intended under the contracts.
Thank you.
Chair Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And what about Jonathan Gruber? He was the one that kind of took us down this trail and said, yeah, this is going to work. We've got all this data. He contracted with the state, and obviously things have changed significantly as far as what he has admitted to himself, and then and factually those documents weren't accurate. Has there been any movement towards a lawsuit against him to try to recover any costs that were taken from the taxpayers of Minnesota?
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, yes, this is a little bit before my time, so bear with me as I've kind of pieced together the history. My understanding is that the state probably close to 2 years ago, contracted with Dr. Gruber to do some analysis of what estimated enrollment would look like in the exchange, and I think some of the fiscal noting that was originally done on the bill was based on that. Those estimates turned out to be not very accurate, not close to accurate, and we now base all of our financial analysis and all of our financial work on what actual enrollment looks like, because we actually have data now to do that. I'm unaware of any discussions right now around potential lawsuits with Dr. Gruber. I know that he also contracted in a number of other states. We haven't been in contact with those states either to sort of see what their plans are, but certainly options are available moving forward should that be a route that folks would like to pursue.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Leitz, just moving forward, I know Oregon, I believe it was, recently just kind of threw in the towel on their exchange. Has that been a consideration at all?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, it's important to remember in Oregon that they actually never enrolled an individual through their exchange. Their exchange quite literally never worked. Nobody was ever able to actually enroll electronically. We're in a different space here. That there's a lot of work to be done to improve the system, but I think the experience that people had the second year was dramatically better than the first year. I'm unaware of any discussions that are occurring about going to the federal exchange. I think that's something that largely the governing board that oversees MNsure largely ruled out in coming into this open enrollment period, and I'm unaware that they're having any discussions about that.
Chair Scott.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess this is for any of the ones up there. I guess I've been asked a question about 16E, which I'm not real familiar with, but about content accessibility and the functionality of the website as far as people with reading disabilities and limited reading, whether during your, Mr. Nobles and the auditor, during your report, did you look at that side of it? And is this, I'm still hearing complaints from people that they're not being able to do this, people get with some learning disabilities, not meeting the 16E requirements in state law.
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Alter. Chairman, we did not look at that issue. I'm well aware of that issue. I think it's a broad issue, not just for MNsure, but throughout state government. That issue is actually brought to the attention of the Office of the Legislative Auditor for our website. I think it's a very challenging problem to fix, frankly. We do produce documents in written words and do, frankly, have some expectation that people are able to read or find some aid in being able to do that. We certainly try to construct our documents and put them on our website so that people that have reading aids will be able to get through our documents. I know there's been some concern about the difficulty of reading tables or charts, but again, I think state government generally, and certainly the Office of the Legislative Auditor, does create, as you well know,
yeah.
this is our product in written words. And so there is, frankly, right now, some expectation that people will either be able to read or find, not through us, but other service providers, some ability to have the report read to them if they're not sighted or for other reasons cannot read.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in another direction, when we talked about the audit function and the data mining function, and that it was said that you can look up individual people, but you can't look at the broad that person XYZ goes in there and is not supposed to be in where they're at. You can look at it that they were in, say, my file, and they were in Representative O'Driscoll's file, but they weren't in. But you can only do that on an individual basis. You can't look at it in a broad sense. Is there a way to build that functionality in, or is that something beyond the capability of what we currently have in the IT world? And I guess that's
Mr. Chairman, if I could just take a shot at that, because we've actually looked at that issue other places. For example, some years ago, we looked at the inappropriate use of driver's license data. And there are mechanisms in place to be able to go in and see in a data system, in a set of data, beyond an individual case, if an individual person has come in an unauthorized way, you can track all of the people that they've gone to look at. So the technology exists to be able to do that kind of monitoring. It does exist in some agencies.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Leitz, there's been a, you know, obviously a series of recommendations here from the legislative auditor. I'm wondering how many of those recommendations you've started to move and how many of them you've had something to do with moving forward to make the changes that have been recommended. And then if so, has that all been done internally, or are there bills moving in the legislature that would address some of those fixes?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I should have paused it before my opening comments to thank the legislative auditor for the really good work that was done here. As always, they did a very thorough and professional job, and we appreciated the interaction with them during the process. Obviously, some of the recommendations are ones where they would require legislative action. For example, changing the organization so that it's appointed by the governor, so that the executive director position is appointed by the governor. There are bills that are looking at the governance structure right now. Certainly on the Senate side, I'm aware of some of those bills. So some of those things are moving. There are other recommendations, frankly, around some of the areas of tracking, for example, that have been raised, where we can do that administratively, and it's something that I believe we're looking at those recommendations very seriously to look at them. So I think it's a combination of what we can do administratively. We typically would act on legislative auditor recommendations. It's something that's good practice for state agencies to do. Auditors spend a lot of time looking for areas that can help agencies improve the work that they're doing. We certainly take those very seriously and take them as ones that we would want to implement. Some of them require law changes, such as the governor appointing as opposed to the board, and that would require legislative action to do that.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Leitz, then, as CEO, what goals have you set then for Minsure moving forward to address not just these recommendations but other things within Minsure that you would like to see happen?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, we set a number of them. One is that, and some of them are broad and frankly less tangible goals, but I think they're important goals nonetheless. So let me talk about a few of them if that's all right. The first is that when I joined the organization a little over a year ago, we put a very high focus on making the organization a much more consumer-friendly organization, the website a much more consumer-friendly website. We really focused this year on making the experience that people have, whether they're going through the site and enrolling in coverage, whether that be in the public or private side, or when they call into our call center, that they actually have a good experience there. And I think we delivered fairly well on that this year. So that's one goal, is to continue to make this a consumer-friendly organization. Secondly, is to create transparency around the work that we do. When I initially joined last December, there really weren't metrics that were out there to be able to track how many people were enrolling, how long the call center wait times were, and all of those things. We put those in place and publish them publicly so that people know how we're doing, so that they're able to track the consumer experience, know how many people are enrolling, know frankly where we are on a number of different levels. We think that's very, very important. A third goal that I set was to proactively improve our relationships with our partners. And when I say partners, I really talk about the counties. I talk about the health plans, agents and brokers who are so critical to enrolling people in the system, navigator organizations, and others. It's less tangible it's hard to measure that in some sense, but that's a goal, a very strong goal that we have. And I think one tangible way we can measure that is on our executive steering committee, a small group of us who actually have responsibility for prioritizing some of the IT build work. We've actually added a county member onto that group to ensure we have direct county input into the work that we're doing. And then the final thing I'll mention, Representative Scott, is that I proactively sought out the leadership and expertise of Minute Services. That was something that I felt coming into the role wasn't being properly tapped. There's a lot of expertise that exists there. We've now established a very clear governance structure for how we build out the IT system moving forward, and that is really driven by the expertise of Minute, working with our vendors, with both Minsure as an organization and DHS as an organization being business partners with Minute as we move that forward.
Thank you.
Chair Scott.
Thank you. And to the folks from the Legislative Auditor's Office, Are there any plans for follow-up at any future date to kind of check in again and see how these recommendations are coming along?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, not specifically, but I have no doubt, given the importance of this, that we will do some follow-up work on the evaluation. But remember, too, that we completed two financial audits that were related to the activities of MNsure, and we have a constant ongoing responsibility, really, to be over at the Department of Human Services checking eligibility determinations. We are, frankly, currently, as we speak, fulfilling our responsibility under federal law to examine the eligibility determination system as we have before. And that report will actually be coming out in the next several weeks. So it is an ongoing responsibility specifically related to the determination of eligibility through the MNsure system. That will never go away.
Thank you.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So did I hear you mention some, so there was a problem getting applications through the website. So there were a lot of people processing the applications by hand. Is that correct?
Who wants it? Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fenton. Yes.
Okay,
Both by hand, and I would say many people made it through electronically eventually, but with a lot more difficulty and kind of hand-holding by whether it was the call center or by navigators or others.
Representative Fenton.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you talk about the protocol used to keep that information safe as it's moving about on a paper track? What processes were in place?
Mr. Alter.
Members, I may defer to MNsure on that question. I don't have a lot of understanding of the paper security.
And as
Mr. Nobles,
the MNsure answers that. Remember, a lot of the paper is at county social service agencies as well. So they have established protocols before MNsure of handling private, not public information that people provide to government. Frankly, we all do in state government. We're all recipients, both electronically and in paper, of a good deal of not public data, and we all have to have security, both physical and electronic, that protects that data.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike Turpin, General Counsel for MNsure. Auditor Nobles actually keyed up exactly kind of the main point. Early on, knowing that the system was one that was going to be utilized by both agencies, there was a decision made to adopt the information and privacy and security policies of the Department of Human Services and implement those as MNsure's own. And so really we're building upon a robust structure of data practices policies that have been in place for handling this type of data. And as Auditor Noble stated, many of those paper applications were in fact processed by the Department of Human Services or by county agencies, and again, implementing policies that they're used to and that had been in place previously under DHS policies.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so I have just a question moving forward. I received an email from a constituent. So they were able to get into the website and apply, get insurance. They were notified that they had insurance. Then they had a catastrophic illness with their toddler and received the bill from the hospital that no insurance was applied, that they did not have insurance, and their information was somewhere lost. So can you address where this information is getting lost, and how can you go back and track that, and how can they, what's the protocol for proper reimbursement once the information is found again?
Mr. Turpin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and again, not knowing the particulars of the case, I mean, I think the terminology of lost, maybe, I'm not sure whether that applies to physically being lost or whether this is something where it's, you know, there's missing information in the system or not enough information to process the application. So I think just sort of not knowing more detail about the specifics of that, I
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fenton, and if you have specifics on the case, we would be happy to follow up with you after the hearing to make sure the case gets resolved. There are a limited number, a much smaller number than last year, but still some cases where information doesn't get transferred to the health plans as rapidly as we would like it to. And that's an area that we need to have improvement on, quite honestly, and it's something where our focus will be this year. But we'd be happy to follow up with you after the hearing.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles and Mr. Alter, in your slide presentation on point number four, where it talks about the lack of authority, and I'm also cross-referencing in the booklet that you hand out pages 47 through 51, where it talks about the board compliance and governance. I guess my first question goes to you, Mr. Nobles, in terms of, could you elaborate, or Mr. Alter, on your discussions with the board on the lack or the amount of communication with Mr. Light's predecessor as it would relate to assurances that Minshew was complying with the schedule of completion on the various tasks, and where that led to in terms of our downfall?
Mr. Alter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, keep in mind that we had a board that was brand new, that was appointed, I believe it was April 30th, 2013, had not worked together before. So they started from scratch, and there was some orientation provided by Minshew staff about, you know, what the organization was and what the plan was going forward. But again, the statute specifically required the board to develop bylaws and policies before it would receive full authority. Now, during those months when the board was doing that, they were having meetings typically twice a month to do that, but also to get updates on kind of where things were at. And staff was providing some updates during that time. But I think what we heard from really virtually all the board members was, first of all, if you know the exchange, you know that there's a lot of ground to cover there if you're trying to orient somebody and give them an update on where things are at. And I think the feeling of the board members was they got some information when they needed a lot of information about where things were at, what the risks were, what still remained to be done. And as I said before, there was a feeling that at times the board members would ask very detailed questions and specific questions to get an understanding of that, but that the responses they would get were not detailed. So there was a frustration that we heard from board members about the amount of information and in some cases the honesty of the information that they got from administrative staff at that time.
Mr. Chairman, if I could also elaborate, I think this is a very important point. You know, if you're going to have a board be in a governance position, I think it's important that that board understand that their role is to verify information, not to simply accept it. You know, the old axiom, trust but verify. If they're not there to do that, it kind of escapes me what they're there to do. I mean, they may be there to do other things. And I understand that that creates a bit of tension, that you have administrators and a board and they all want to work together and they all want to be on a good collegial relationship. But we know from interviewing the chair, I interviewed the chair of the Minshew board, Mr. Alter interviewed others, including Mr. Forsythe. We interviewed the governor about the amount of information they all received. And again, I think they correctly put some responsibility. I might add to that, we also interviewed the Commissioner of Human Services, who is also on the Minshew board, as you know. And all of them said what Mr. Alter just said. We didn't receive always good, detailed, accurate information. I would put it back on them. It's partly your responsibility. If you weren't being given documents to verify what you're being told, ask for them, require them, insist upon getting them. I mean, we, for example, knew that there had been independent outside IT reviews that were ongoing at Minshew, and board members didn't know about them. They should have known. They should have asked for them. They should have insisted on them. So there was, I think, with all due respect to having citizens come in and volunteer their time and work hard, there was too much passivity on the part of the board. And that's frankly one of the reasons I think some people feel like there's a question on whether or not we should go forward with the board. Maybe the board can become more active and do more to verify information and provide leadership for Minshew. But I think it was not there in the past.
Mr. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, I wholeheartedly concur with your statements. I think it speaks to the naivete of people being placed on a board for which they have no expertise in understanding what questions to ask when they don't see the information that would lead them to a better decision-making process about how to move the project forward. That being said, my next question, Mr. Chair, if you indulge me, is for Mr. Turpin as Chief Counsel for Minshew. But as a participant would go onto the site and engage in the purchase of insurance from the state or through whomever is sponsoring or facilitating that policy, my understanding, and I'm not an attorney, I know enough to know that would be a willing buyer and a willing seller that would then engage in a contract to perform. With the stories that you've heard at this meeting and others where that duty has not been sufficiently accomplished on behalf of the state, on behalf of Minshew and the board, with respect to an individual or a family who is in the process of not knowing whether or not they have insurance or not, but yet have extenuating bills that have not been accomplished and have not been fulfilled, do you not, as the legal counsel representing Minshew, would you not say that there is a breach of that duty to perform on behalf of Minshew? And what redress, sir, would the individuals that have complied in full faith with that website on behalf of the established protocol, what redress do they have for the damages that they have been incurred upon?
Mr. Turpin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it would really depend on the facts presented in a specific case, but I can say what we have done is built structures in place as required under federal law to provide due process to individuals to seek appeal. There's a broad fair hearing function within Minshew that allows for both administrative review of any issues. That administrative review can then be taken up both to the federal level. The Department of Health and Human Services offers a further review of that fair hearing. Additionally, there would be an opportunity for judicial review of that within the state. So there are mechanisms that currently are available to individuals who feel that they identify issues that cause concern or were problems with their enrollment. We have those in place. We have contact center staff who can provide individuals with that pathway. Those are identified on our website, so you can clearly see, go on and see how to file an appeal. There's a way to electronically file that appeal and queue it up. The individuals hearing those appeals are independent and objective individuals. We actually utilize the same system that the Department of Human Services utilizes for public assistance fair hearings. So these are individuals who are completely separate from the eligibility and enrollment process and really provide an independent and objective review of the facts of a specific case and allow for a mechanism to provide redress to some of the things that you're discussing.
Mr. Chair. Final follow-up, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Turpin, if you could just elaborate in terms of your knowledge in terms of the number of appeals that have been submitted electronically and or the ones that are being facilitated via paper flow. And Mr. Nobles, if you would please comment in terms of your objective opinion in terms of how that appeals process would be expedited for the sake of people that are in duress based upon not having insurance coverage.
Mr. Turpin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative, I can actually address on the expedited process. Federal law, and actually implemented by the the MNSURE eligibility appeals rule. We have a process for an expedited appeal process for individuals with a medical emergency, and we have processed some of those where individuals have identified that. That's, again, a review by an independent, objective, fair hearing judge that reviews the facts of the situation and can provide for an expedited appeal process. Our volume is quite large. Again, we're tapping into an existing process that handles these fair hearings on an ongoing basis at the Department of Human Services. So really, we matched our rules to the existing rules that exist for fair hearings for public assistance programs. So really, being able to plug into that system has been very efficient. Electronic appeal process has worked well. I would have to get back to you on the exact numbers, but it is a large number that have been serviced. I will say also that the vast majority of those, over 75% of those, actually were resolved without requiring going to a fair hearing, which really speaks to the work and diligence of the staff, both at the Department of Human Services and within MNSURE, to try to work to resolve consumer issues without having to sort of have that continue on to a fair hearing. So a lot of those were resolved prior to hearing.
Representative
Mr. Noble.
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, it's not a part of the process that we examine, but I'd be happy to put that on the list to make sure that it's working as it needs to.
Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Question for the panel. One of the first assumptions that I think you said that you made, Mr. Leitz, was that you went on Dr. Gruber's assumptions, but now you're going to be able to use the baseline information that you've been provided by the number of enrollees that you currently have. And would it be safe for the committee and the general population of Minnesota to believe now that since you enrolled, I believe, 49,238, roughly 11% of what was projected, should we then expect lower enrollment numbers or more realistic numbers? Can you address that for us, please?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's my understanding that the work that was done by Dr. Gruber when the bill was being discussed was what were the numbers that were used in the fiscal noting. I think we've discovered that those numbers were not near what the actual enrollment was. And I think what I was indicating is that the numbers that we're using for our financial modeling and for our enrollment projections are really based off what we actually are experiencing. And those numbers are indeed lower than what Dr. Gruber had anticipated or predicted.
Mr. Chair, follow up on that.
Representative Nash.
So the number, you do concur that the 49,000 number?
Mr. Chair, Lutz. Representative Nash, we concluded last year's enrollment period with approximately I believe that's probably an accurate number. During this open enrollment period, we've enrolled a little over 60,000, so it's somewhere in that ballpark.
Mr. Chair, so would it, again, back to my original question, would it be safe to assume that you're going to be adjusting your your assumed numbers downward and that your budget may accordingly follow that as a result?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I apologize for not picking up on that thread. Yeah, the board will be meeting on Thursday and we'll be presenting a three-year financial plan for their approval. We're required by state law to submit to the legislature by March 15th our budget, and that will be a part of that. I would anticipate that there will be some discussion of the numbers as they were originally presented and whether based on the 60,000 enrollment relative to the target that had been set of around 67,000, whether we'll need to make some adjustments accordingly.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Second question. I have a constituent, and actually a good number of constituents, that have reached out to me to talk about what I believe is the nomenclature of life event additions, which I think we could all agree have been disastrous to date. And I'll share a little bit of what was told to me by them. They had a new baby, which is a great thing. But in trying to sign up, they were asked a series of questions that I think are kind of silly. One, why is your child seeking insurance? Does your child desire to live at home? Why is your child seeking insurance? and they went through a process of what they told me would to be 2 weeks to get their child signed up. Now, when I and my wife had our sixth kids, we just called and added the kids, and there you were. Have we addressed this? Are you going to be able to provide a solution so that people like my constituent aren't going to pull their hair out and say mean things to their computer screen?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, The life event issue has indeed been one that has been extremely vexing for consumers and the counties, and frankly for all of our partners. And it's one that, unfortunately, the initial functionality of the site did not have the ability to make those changes electronically or to have individuals be able to make them. The process that they go through is essentially by contacting our call center, and we make those adjustments for them. When I mentioned earlier that the process moving forward is really to build out various functions that don't exist and have that available for the open enrollment period, that is life events is very, very high, if not the highest issue on that priority list. We do understand the frustration it causes, and it's a reasonable frustration, and so it's very, very high on our list to be able to address within that context.
Final follow-up, Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And this for Mr. Lights and Mr. Nobles, perhaps. I've been contacted by a private exchange. You may be familiar with a company called Gravy. They are a private exchange, and they have stood the whole thing up for less than $2 million and some additional development afterwards. They're operating in 50 states, and they're actually servicing much more robustly than I believe you are. And Mr. Nobles, I guess the question is, when you were auditing, did you find there might be a case to be made for a public-private partnership to bring in to assist with some of the deficiencies we see that are pretty glaring?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nash, I think those are always partnerships we need to pursue. In fact, I'm sure as anyone here can tell you, and I think everybody at this table knows, we really built the MNsure system with the assistance of outside vendors, IBM, others. And so I think there's always, I mentioned also that we brought in Deloitte, but I think, frankly, MNsure, anybody in state government ought to find out where things work, why they work, and borrow and pay for, if necessary, all the good ideas that will help us improve.
Sure, thank you.
Final question, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two very brief questions. The first is for Mr. Lights, and I'm wondering, I've received quite a bit of feedback from constituents waiting for tax documents in order to process their returns, and I'm wondering if you have an update on the status of that.
Mr. Lights.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the question that you asked is really related to, I believe, what are called the 1095As, which are forms that consumers are filing if they receive a tax credit through the exchange to purchase private health insurance coverage, and it's really a form that they're required to file to be able to reconcile against their taxes. We are, as of either later today or early tomorrow, will be fully completed with the mailing of all of those forms.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that answer. That's just great. And I also wanted to thank Mr. Nobles for the great work that you and your team have done on this. I had another question that surfaced during this hearing, and I quickly went to the table of contents and the section and can see that my answer is right here. So just great work. My second question is for Mr. Turpin, and you referenced the appeals process and that 75% of the issues didn't actually make it to a hearing, didn't need to go to a hearing. So I'm wondering how many hearings there have been and approximately what kind of, you know, time commitment and cost might there have been as a result of this appeals process to taxpayers of the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Turpin.
Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, you know, I'm trying to take this in two parts, so I'd have to get back to you with the exact number. You know, I want to say it's in the 1500 range, but that includes also joint hearings with the Department of Human Services for the Medicaid and Minnesota care eligibility. We saved a lot of money with setting up the system this way by having those hearings simultaneous. So there is both are required to have hearings, and so having them separately obviously would have increased costs. We are able to hear those jointly. So a lot of those may be singly medical assistance or Minnesota care appeals. Some of them might be APTC or QHP eligibility. So there, it really runs the gamut. So I would have to get back to you on precise numbers, but we do have those. In terms of cost, you know, one of the metrics that we've been looking at is, one, utilizing an existing state structure, the fair hearings process, and matching it to the current structure that exists within DHS for public assistance appeals really allows us to look at the cost and match it to that. So we weren't creating anything new with regard to the format of the hearing. Additionally, what we've seen is actually a lower percentage of appeals that are arising from these eligibility determinations than were historically arising from eligibility determinations out of public programs. So our factor is down a little bit, but it's in the range, but it's down a little bit. So we actually, when we were planning and anticipating, we were looking more likely for a higher volume. It's a new program. These are new programs. People may have questions about them. We were actually assuming that there was going to be an increase and much higher. That really hasn't occurred. And so I think a part of that factor is the customer service wraparound that's being provided at the front end, both through the call center and through other contacts, assisters, navigators, etc.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Turpin. Thank you, Mr. Leitz. We really appreciate it. Mr. Nobles, Mr. Alter, thank you very much for your work. We will adjourn the Joint Committee, and the Government Operations Committee will gavel in 2 minutes. The Joint Committee is adjourned. Morning again. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee meeting to order. Representative Pugh, would you make a motion on the minutes from March 5th?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes from March 5th.
Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes from March 5th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Minutes are adopted.
Sounding.
With that, we'd like to welcome Representative Kahn to the committee for House File 18. Representative Nelson, would you like to move the bill?
Okay, I'll move the bill, House File 18, to go. We can determine that later. I'll move House File 18 to have it in front of us.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Kahn, to your bill.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, this is a pretty simple bill that we probably, it should have never have been necessary. If it had been up to the House, it never would have been necessary. I know this is the one piece of Minsure legislation I think that you could pass unanimously. What happened was that when the Minsure legislation, what this does is this removes an exemption from Minsure laws relating to the Office of Minute Services. What happened was when the Minsure bill first appeared in the House in Representative Nelson's committee, they had a total exemption of Minsure from everything relating to Minute. Then it might have then been the Office of Environmental Technology. I threw a small fit and said that the bill wasn't going to get out of committee with this exemption, and the chair agreed with me, and the bill didn't get out of committee. and the bill went out of committee, but with the exemption removed. This is something good for freshman legislators to learn. I followed it through every step of the process, waiting till they were going to try and put it back in. It, however, was not put in until the last hour of the conference committee. And even if I had discovered it then, I think with such a difficult subject and with something that so few people are interested in, I'm not sure I could have done anything about it. We have John Eichten is here from Minute. I supposedly had a press release coming, which I didn't seem to manage to get to me, which says that the state IT reforms have saved Minnesota taxpayers $27.4 million. I think that's now up to, since they were inaugurated in 3 years, I think that's now up to $40 million. I was hoping to have, but he obviously got too busy telling people how to give back this saved money to the people. I was hoping to have my former colleague, Representative Downey, here, who had been the chief author of this bill when we passed it. I was the chief author the year before, and then he was the chief author the next year when we passed the Minute Consolidation Bill. Jonathan, the governor's office supports this. Jonathan Eichten is here from Minute to say that they support it. And as I said, I think it's the one piece of legislation dealing with Minsure that we should be able to pass unanimously. And I know you have much longer than the bill. You have the House research analysis of all the things that were exempted.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Do you think this is a great bill and one of the legislative recommendations from the legislative auditor,
yes,
which we just heard from? So appreciate this bill and the work that you've done so far on this. Any member questions to House File 18?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Chair, thank you. And Representative Kahn. I'll go this way. Just wanted to say that I do support this and did sign on. I'm happy to be an author with you and do believe that this is a very good step to address some of the issues that have caught the attention of many in the press and here in the legislature. And I do support this and would be happy to volunteer to be your next Keith Downey.
Okay. As long as you don't, Mr. Chairman, as long as you don't leave the legislature to become chairman of some other organization.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have no such aspirations.
Any other member questions or comments? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, can you walk us through the process as you would understand it in terms of why there was such a dedication to exempting Minshew from MNIT?
Representative Kahn.
I understand and that one of the thoughts was that they thought the need for speed was essential and that it would slow up the process to do it. You'll have to ask Senator Lowry or you'll have to ask some senators as to why, because the House, until it came to conference committee, never agreed to it.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, had we had not implemented an exemption for Minshew, in your wisdom and in your years in the legislature, particularly as it would pertain,
yes,
to technology, what type of a picture would you paint for Minshew in light of not having that exemption on the books over the last 18 months?
Okay.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the technological, first of all, as I understand it, when the leadership of Minshew that changed, the new leadership was much more amenable to dealing with MNIT than the previous leadership had been. And so, in fact, they may be acting even now as if there's no exemption, you know, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't change the law to make the law fit how they're acting. I know that at some of the meetings, and of course I'm not a health person, so I was never involved in any of these meetings, someone in the governor's office said, why would we take the most complicated technological thing we've ever done away from the people who understand technology? And I think that's the question that we really needed to ask. No one, not even, as I said, John Eichten was here, if you want to have someone from MNIT, if you want to have someone give some more informed. I think no one will say there would have been no problems without this exemption, but I think everyone, as the legislative auditor said, is willing to say that the exemption should not have occurred.
Any other member questions or comments? Seeing none, anyone in the audience who wishes to testify, come on down, sir. If you would, introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent.
Thank you, Chair, for this opportunity to speak, and members of the Operation Committee at the House. I'm speaking on House File 18. My name is Rick Heller, and I officially represent the twice exceptional and disabled. So, I've been asking a few questions to myself about how it's called plain language, and it has to do with this bill, I think, too. Perhaps it might be missing in it. Plain language is a requirement. It goes back quite a few years. I think it's in somewhere in 144 area of our statutes. It talks about setting the reading level for your intended audience. I believe the health department is to set the reading level at a seventh grade. However, Jay Wyant, Chief Information Officer at MNIT, has recommended AAA of web content accessibility guidelines has to do with understandability. I believe perhaps Minute could, if they would be willing to yield to a question I had to them, help us understand not just about content accessibility law, but also what understandability is when you make a website appropriate for the intended audience.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Acton. If you would, introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, John Acton, Legislative Director for Minute Services. And this is an issue I've discussed previously with Rick. I'm doing some due diligence back with our Chief Information Accessibility Officer, Jay Wyant, to try and understand the AAA guidelines. And I'll be working with Rick to work through the issue and clarify what those guidelines are and any issues that are resulting from them in terms of accessibility of information on state websites. We're going to be working diligently to work through those.
Thank you, Mr. Acton. Thank you, Mr. Heller.
The question I have for Ms. Acton, it's been kind of a long, ongoing discussion. I'd like to just express a few things, and maybe Ms. Acton, or if you could get back to this committee, I think it would be appropriate for the intended audience. Is when I've talked to Jay Wyant, I've been at a public meeting, I believe it was called the TAC committee, about a month ago, and I had asked specifically, and it's in the transcript, obviously, because currently there's a data request regarding those transcript minutes, and I asked Jay Wyant specifically if he has governance over state agencies when it comes to, for instance, have an accessibility policy, and he said no. And the other question that came up had to, is he required to have a state agency to have a strategy plan, which is, quote, a plan that if somebody creates a document or creates a website that's not functional, that they remove them and have them trained. Again, it's my understanding he says he has no governance over that. Currently, this statute has no rules to underpin the statute. My suggestion is the sonar hearing to help develop, to give Jay more governance with not just MNTSHR, with other state agencies. So I guess the question, if maybe Ms. Eichner can answer it now, if that's correct, if he knows the governance of Minute, or maybe someone else here that's from Minute.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. I saw Mr. Acton taking vigorous notes there, so if he can attempt to answer your question, otherwise I'm sure he'll continue to work offline with you. Mr. Acton.
Mr. Chair, happy to do my best with this. The TAC committee that Rick mentions is the Technology Accessibility Advisory Committee. I think the question is, what is Minute's level of governance or authority around these issues? I'll say that the line between technology, where Minute has clear authority, and content of agency websites is unclear in terms of where that line exists, but we do have technology accessibility standards that are in place that agencies are required to follow. We do not have rulemaking authority, though. In terms of getting more information, I'm happy to again work with Rick, and I'll get back to the committee with more in-depth answers after I consult with the other staff in my office.
Thank you, Mr. Acton. Just final follow-up, Mr. Heller.
Respect to the chair, I ask one more simple question, and maybe Ms. Acton can echo this again. Last year, the question came up in committee when they rescind a lot of the law surrounding this, and the question came up, is the legislature exempt from content accessibility law? Perhaps you can answer that question as well to remind everybody.
Mr. Eichter, I'm not sure if you would have an answer for the entire legislature. But.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of being entirely accurate, I'm going to have to get back to the committee on that one. I'm not sure. I know the standards apply to state agencies. My suspicion is that they don't apply to the legislature, but I don't want to speak definitively.
Thank you, Mr. Eichter. Thank you, Mr. Heller, for bringing this to our attention. We appreciate it.
I also appreciate that he makes a document with their letterhead that's stamped for the blind. You know, you put a letterhead on it. It's a PDF. So the legislature currently is suggesting to use Adobe Reader, which reads out loud, and that the appropriate parties be responded. Yeah, they can copy me on this, but this is really the audience for the leadership to take up, not me, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Any final, Mr. Acton.
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to thank Representative Kahn for bringing this bill forward. Just to reiterate what she had said, Minute does support the bill. I would say that functionally there wouldn't be a change resulting. As the auditors noted, we do have a governance structure in place with Minute, DHS, and Minsure leadership on the Executive Steering Committee. But that said, removing the exemptions is something we support. and again, we thank her for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Mr. Eichten. Representative Kahn, any final comments before Representative Nelson renews his motion?
I'm just, Mr. Chairman, just on the excitement of having a Minsure bill that I think that could pass unanimously, I think you ought to just send it to the floor.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hopefully this doesn't become a Christmas tree Minsure bill, but yeah. I'll renew my motion that House File 18 be referred to the State Government Finance Committee.
All in favor of House File 18, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? House File 18 is passed and referred to State Government Finance. Thank you, Representative Kahn. Members, I know that we have a full agenda tomorrow and Thursday. As well, in your packets, I believe in the meeting section, there is a list of House files that are being referred to the subcommittee on Metropolitan Government or the Met Council. So you can take a look at that. With that, members, we are adjourned.